It's interesting, I was in Africa in 1976, and I spent some considerable time there, not just a week or two, but I was there for an extended period on a contract job I was doing. And I was in many countries in Africa. Any of you ever spent any time in Africa? You know then, four or five hands go up, how they drive there. There are no traffic laws of any kind in most of Africa. And you take your life in your hands. And you get into the front of a taxi cab, and you probably should have a change of clothes with you. It's very scary. And finally, after I was there about 3 or 4 months, I was in Casablanca watching them zip through the streets, zing, zoo, and I was like, whoa, this is maddening, this is insanity. And I finally said to some cab driver who spoke a little bit of English, how can you drive like this? There are no stoplights, there are no signals, there are no rules of the road, there's no right of way, you just guys just get in the car and go. I mean, the rule of the road is called my horn. And he said, oh, there are very few accidents here, very few. So I checked with the American embassy there, who did just kind of a little bit of research for me as a service. Came back and told me 3 days later what the statistics were for traffic deaths and traffic accidents and serious injuries in Central West Africa. Practically nil per capita compared to what's going on in Manhattan, where there are all sorts of laws, rules, and regulations. Is that amazing? See, self-regulation is the best regulation. Humankind, after all, does not sink to the lowest common denominator, but left to its own device, rises to its highest thought. How many of you think that? I'm just curious. About half of you. I'm not saying that if we simply lifted all sense of duty and responsibility, and for that matter lifted all laws or had no government or whatever, that we would all behave the same way. We wouldn't. We would do things, most of us, that are now against the law. We might, for instance, to pick a relatively benign example, drive more than 55 miles an hour. I know that none of us do that now, but we might do that. And we would do some other things that we now claim are against the law. If a woman walks down the street in a particularly provocative way and offers certain services and favors to others, and primarily members of the opposite gender, she is very likely, if she's caught, to be prosecuted for prostitution. On the other hand, if she does the exact same thing in Reno, Nevada, they say that she's adding to the tax base, leading one to ask the question, what is it that is in fact the problem? Is it the act of prostitution or is it geography? So now I'm just curious, as we close down this particular portion of our exploration, I'm just kind of curious. How many of you believe the statement, I don't owe anybody anything at all? Raise your hand. Well, about 2/3 of you. That's very nice. I'd like to encourage you to give yourself permission to stay in process with that and explore it, because I promise you this. If you could get to a place where you accepted as your functioning reality, I don't owe anybody anything, then at last you could do the things you are doing without feeling resentment or anger, without coming from obligation or responsibility or duty. You may not change a single thing that you're doing. You may do the same things tomorrow you're doing today, but you will do them for an entirely different reason and coming from an entirely different place. Get that you are all coming from choice, and saying that you're doing it because it's my duty or because I owe it to them is merely a mechanical, verbal, and mental device allowing you to feel bad about a decision you've made. And that's okay if you enjoy feeling bad about it, but if you don't, then cut it out. It's just dropping our attitude, because when we shift our perception of why we're doing a thing, it changes our attitude. All right. Now, let's go to the next question. Who had a reaction? Who felt that their life would change if the following statement were true? Nobody needs my help.
This was a question that I had the most difficulty with, and I think that I've always gained self-worth by people needing my help and me helping others. So I think I struggled with this one the most.
Yeah. Thank you for being so transparent. Many people gain their sense of self-worth out of their idea that they're helping someone else. But if nobody needed your help, then from whence would your value come? The trigger word indeed is nobody needs my help. And that does not mean that we wouldn't appreciate or enjoy or love to have the help of one another. But if we think that someone needs us to help them, we make two statements. Number one, we are valuable because someone else needs us. And number two, the other person is essentially helpless and can't do without us. Both statements are a lie, an intellectual lie. Yet if those statements drive the engine of your experience, you will be devastated when that person you've been helping demonstrates to you that they no longer need your help and probably never did. Rather than being glorified and congratulating yourself, you'll be devastated because, of course, the jig is up and the game is over. To our next question. In what way would your life change, if at all, if the following statement were true? I don't need anybody's help at all.
I know there are things that I want to do, and I think I've been waiting for somebody to help me with them. So if I believe this, I just go ahead and do them.
Yes. Yes. That's a wonderful shift and a wonderful change. If that were to happen in your life, that would be marvelous. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyone else have a sharing on this subject?
I may be doing a flip side on this. I have been operating my whole life as if I don't need anyone else's help. Part of it comes from being an only child and circumstances of, you know, the life I've created. For me to be willing to ask for anyone's help is a major, major obstacle for that I face anytime I'm, and I find ways of doing it without anybody else's help. And it's, in truth, I think my spirit will grow more when I can learn to ask for that and receive it.
Yes, but you will never learn to ask for it and receive it so long as you hold it in the place of, I need their help. I've just given you the springboard to your freedom, because you'll be able to ask for it and receive it when you hold it in a new way. I don't need help from anyone at all, and I've demonstrated that for 50 years. But what is also true is I'd be very happy to receive it. I could use it from time to time. It would make things easier, and easier is something I am now willing to experience.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's really good.
All right, now the next statement. In what way, if at all, would your life change if the following statement were true? Nobody does anything they don't want to do.
Well, if I did only what I wanted to do, I realized that I probably wouldn't change my actions at all because I think I do everything I truly want to do in my heart.
Ah, but, bingo, there you are. That's my point.
But what I would change, I think, is probably the attitude, maybe a little bit.
Ta-da! That's, you know, my point precisely.
Being a single parent of three teenagers, very often I have to make choices. Every day in my life I make choices. Personal choices, you know, things that I need to do for my children, things that I want to do for myself. And a lot of times I feel like I'm compromising myself a little bit in making those choices. But really, this question was really helpful to me because I don't really compromise myself at all. I have to ask myself, is this something, if I didn't do this, how would I feel? If I do this, how do I feel? And ultimately, I make the right choice.
The choice that's right for you.
Exactly.
Because every act is an act of self-definition.
So I really don't compromise myself. Things that I do from my heart.
Thank you for seeing that. Thank you for seeing that.
Thank you for sharing the question.
We're now jumping ahead to the last of the seven wisdoms. In what way would your life change, if in any way at all, if the following statement were true? There's no such thing as right and wrong. What the statement means, let's be clear, is that objectively, right and wrong do not exist. There is no objective right and wrong. We've demonstrated that over and over again in this universe by changing our ideas about what we call right and wrong from time to time, and sometimes from moment to moment. Yet subjectively, that is to say, in our own subjective experience, we have declared and defined certain things as what we call right and certain things as what we call wrong, and ever we must do so if we are to define ourselves in any meaningful way. Do you understand? So what I'm saying to you as an example is this. A few years ago in Salem, Massachusetts, they grabbed the women out of their backyards and pulled them into the town square, accusing them of witchcraft, for performing certain rituals, for daring to say that they honor the spirit of the North, South, and East, and West, or whatever other ritual it was in their minds to perform. And we said in the town square, you will either admit that you were performing witchcraft and denounce yourself for doing that, or we will hang you or burn you. And several refused to denounce themselves and were hanged and burned. I might add that this was done in the name of God. Now, I'm not making this up. This actually happened. Today, if the same thing happened, we would say that the people who are burning them at the stake and hanging them on those platforms are what we call wrong. Whereas in those days, we said that the hangers and the burners were right. And the crowd cheered as they did it. And that the women were wrong. Now, what has changed there? What has changed is simply our minds. We've changed our minds about that. We've decided something else. Do you see? So I give you one example, and we could come up with hundreds of examples. I give you one example of how we as a culture, as a race, as a society, have changed our minds about what we call right and wrong. Right and wrong is a function of time and space. Right and wrong is a reflection of our current thought about a thing. And nothing more. Nothing more. So be careful when you decide that something is wrong, lest your current thought about that change in a few years. And I promise you it will. That's why self-righteousness is so dangerous. Because self-righteousness suggests that what was wrong yesterday will be wrong tomorrow. And I want to go back now to wisdom statement number 6 very quickly and just explain to you so we don't skip over that one and forget it. No one does anything inappropriate given their model of the world. That was number 6. Number 7 was there's no such thing as right and wrong. And what I want you to know is this particular one isn't open to debate. This is just what's so. No one does anything inappropriate given their model of the world. And when we understand that no one does anything inappropriate given their model of the world, then we don't judge people or make them wrong. We simply seek to understand, and if it serves us, to alter their model of the world. That's what our institutions of correction were originally conceived of as doing. These were originally called correctional institutions, not punishment institutions. And in the highly evolved societies of the universe, there are actually correctional facilities, not punishment places. We should call our prisons punishment places, because that's what they are. They don't try to correct anything. Now, there have been some politicians and some world leaders who have understood that no one does anything wrong given their model of the world, and that the problem is that we disagree with their model. And those people are people who have saved us from war from time to time. Peacemakers from the beginning of time on the planet are those who have refused the common version that you're wrong and I'm right. And might is right, and even when I'm wrong and you could be right, I'm still going to be right because I'm bigger than you. What we need to do to end all the behaviors in the world that we have decided collectively are inappropriate, and by the way, we get to make those decisions. And we do make those decisions, and rightly so. Now the question is, how can we get those who are acting inappropriately by our definition to change their actions? Well, we have to change their model of the world. If we want the kids in Southwest Los Angeles to change their actions, we've got to change their model of the world. If we want the people in Bosnia to change their actions, we have to change their model of the world. The model of the world that's held by most people is, we're better than you. As a matter of fact, that's the model of the world held by most of the world's religions, which says something about religion. I made a statement on the radio about 6 months ago, which was rather astonishing, and produced a rash of telephone calls, the likes of which I haven't heard on talk radio in quite a while. I said this: there is no one person or organization that's any holier or better than another. There is no one religion that is holier or better than another. Beware if your religion is telling you we're the only ones who have the whole truth. Beware if your political party is telling you we're the only ones who've got it totally right. Beware of anyone who says we have it and they don't. So no one does anything inappropriate given their model of the world. And when we are clear about that, we get off of our judgments and we start focusing our energies on changing the model of the world from which they come and with which we profoundly disagree. And those efforts undertaken with focused energy very often produce positive results, as we've discovered in paradigm-shifting programs that change people's basic models of the world. So that's the sixth and last, we went to number seven earlier, of the seven wisdoms. And I wanted to share that with you so that you could take that with you and include it as part of your tool chest.